This lady just told me she'll be back when we're done.
Are you leaving me too?
Oh, okay. My name's Marie Stinner and I'm an alcoholic. They didn't take my money. Good. Probably the most important thing I have to say up here, if you're new, is that I used to drink and I don't anymore. I've been up since 9 o'clock this morning and I haven't had a drink. That's a long time. There are many people afflicted with this disease that have never heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous, and they don't want to drink. And they're drinking right now. And they're filled with all the self-loathing, the confusion, the hopelessness, the torment, the loneliness, self-disgust that I had with me 15 and a half years ago, right now. And I've gone a long time this morning without a drink. It's 5 minutes till 12. That's 3 hours. And you know, before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, moments were long. Days lasted eternities. Because I died every day. 1,000 deaths every time a phone rang. If there was a phone. Every time that happened, or anything, I died every day. And I don't want to forget that at all. I hope it's not an omen for those of you who are sitting in the audience today that all the other speakers have left. I was ready to talk last night. I'm not ready to talk this morning. I'm just not. One of your members asked me, what do you do about your ego when you speak and stuff like that? I found that participating in Alcoholics Anonymous, speaking at conventions and things, are just like everything else that this program is designed to do. It's designed for ego deflation. You know, they call me months ahead of these things. I mean, I'm going to Louisiana in Labor Day of 1988. They think I'm going to be sober. That just cracks me up. And if you only do it once a year, you can kind of plan 3 months in ahead to be spiritually fit the morning you get up there. You know what I mean? But I'm called on to do this quite a bit. And I have the same problems with alcoholism all of you have. Every bit. But I also have the solution that the man talked about last night. I've been walking the path for a while, and it's worked for me. I'm here this morning. I don't know how long I'm supposed to talk. Anybody got any information? Okay, great. I'm here this morning to tell you a little bit of what I used to be like. You know, Stockton's very special for me. I don't know how many of you know that I lived here when I was 2 years sober. I lived here almost a year. A miracle happened in my life here, as many other miracles have happened. I arrived in Stockton 2 years sober, hair frizzed out to here, turquoise from my fingers to my toes, wearing Levi's, and cursing every other word, and I thought I was normal. I came from L.A. I came from kind of a low-bottom group. The closest person back then, there was just Midtown and one other miscellaneous meeting. Do you know what I mean? At Midtown, we didn't claim many other meetings. It was just basically Midtown. And that's the way they got me. Now, Virgil Green was there, and I understand Virgil has passed, and Bob Curry, and God, there were some wonderful people there. And I hit this town thinking I was normal. And the nearest person in my group to my age was 45, and I had just turned 25. And there were no other young people, and those people didn't know what to make of me. And there were lots of Al-Anons in my group. And it was here that I became Marie rather than Murray, which is what I had been in Los Angeles. It was here that I watched people and I learned how to talk. It was here that I tried on dresses. It was here that I learned how to play bingo. Now that doesn't sound like much to you. But it was kind of, it was a wonderful thing that happened to me here. A wonderful thing. I had nothing in common with the people in the group, other than the disease of alcoholism. And the recovery is laid out in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe that was my blessing. You see, when I was rendered sober, something's happening in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not too sure what it is, because I'm not real bright, but I watch a lot. And when I was rendered sober, it's like now in Alcoholics Anonymous, they got the gay groups over here, they got the silk sheet groups over here, they got the narcotics addicts over there, they got the motorcycles over here, and we got so big that everybody only gets to go with their own kind, or what they think is their own kind. But when I was rendered sober, it was at a time when Alcoholics Anonymous was still small enough that we were just all thrown in together. We were just all thrown in together. And we had nothing in common outwardly. We came from all different backgrounds. Like the big book says in There's a Solution, it talks about we are people that would not normally mix. And I saw that in the group I got sober in. Our backgrounds, we were totally different. Our ages, our financial backgrounds, our educations, our sexual preference, everything about us was different. And yet, we were all the same. One thing I am absolutely convinced of, having been here sober as long as I am, is that the people vary, but the disease doesn't. People vary, but the disease doesn't. It runs a charitable course. It's a devastating disease. I was born in Georgia and raised in Oklahoma. Now I believe that being from the South is a whole nother disease. It's taken me a lot longer to get over being Southern than it has my alcoholism, but I was born into an area that I didn't fit with the values. I, like Alan, I hurt all my life. I hurt all my life, and I was many years sober. In fact, I was from 10 to 13 years sober before an inventory. I was able to go back and see the time that I began to develop the event in my life where I began to develop the over-exaggerated ego, the over-exaggerated sense of self-concern that leads to fears and resentments and exaggerated remorse that seems to characterize the alcoholic. Now, my event was probably different than yours, but we seem to have developed that, with one exception. I'll tell you, in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it gives a few categories of alcoholics in the doctor's opinion. And it talks about the ones that seem to be normal in every respect except their allergy to alcohol. I want you to know that's not me. And I now acknowledge that there are many of you. For many years, I compared myself to people in AA. And it seemed like people would just come in here and they got well and better and everything got fine. And for a long time, I thought they were liars. They were just not getting honest. You know what I mean? Until one more time, I went back to the textbook. And it says in there that there are people that don't have the problems I had. That they were normal in many respects. And I see them, and now I'm able to embrace them and no longer compare myself to them. And one more time, have a little bit more freedom. But I began to develop this over-exaggerated ego. I'd like to tell you some of the value systems that I accepted that have little or nothing to do with me. I'm very glad I'm a speaker here this morning just so that it wouldn't be a men's stag. You know what I mean? I love the reference in the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous to the fact that women suffer too. Isn't that cute? It was nice they told us. It was nice they told us. But coming into this universe with the cloak of a female body, I was prey to a lot of the attitudes about women. I wanted to be just like everybody else. And anybody that's from the South knows that women are for breeding. I mean, it's a simple fact. In my family, women weren't very important, except that they could reproduce and that, in fact, that wasn't even important. It was terribly important that whatever I did in life, whether it was learn to walk, talk, go to college, although that was never mentioned to me, anything I ever did was so that I could grow up someday, get a man, so that I could then be something. Okay. Now, I was taught some values. I don't know if you talk about sex in Stockton, but I'll tell you this. The textbook Alcoholics Anonymous finds it important enough that it dedicates over a quarter of the inventory proceedings to it. A quarter of the inventory proceedings. And it was not the actual sex act, but like many other things in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was the resentment, the fear, and all of that behind it that has caused me problems in my life. And I was taught that the things, you know, you be nice, you do good, you go to vacation Bible school, and then you grow up and you get a man so you could be someone. And some of the values I was taught about sex was like, if a man could go to a library and check out a library book, he'd have no reason to buy it. Okay? Now, having been checked out at a very young age, I knew that nobody was ever going to buy me, which absolutely proved not to be true later on in the streets of Los Angeles. I made a lot of money. But I threw myself away. You're looking at a human being, a homo sapien, that absolutely threw herself away. For all intents and purposes, I murdered the person that you saw standing up here this morning. I have needed an answer all my life. I have needed freedom from me all my life. I absolutely believe what the big book says is true, that selfishness, concentration on self. It took me so many years in Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't understand the words. I just didn't understand the words. When people would talk about selfishness, I thought that was like being stingy. And I thought my problem was that I wasn't stingy enough. You know, I was too nice. I didn't know the word selfish meant concentration on self. I did words like egotism, ego. I had ego mixed up with conceit, which is a form of egotism. But the word ego, I didn't know until some people in AA took the time to teach me. The word ego means I am. That's all it means. And I had many years and many problems in Alcoholics Anonymous that I couldn't identify my egotism because I thought I was the worst. I thought I was horrible. I couldn't identify resentment because I had it mixed up with hostility, which is a form, it's a manifestation of resentment. It was many years before I was able to read the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous the way it was written. And when it got to that part in the inventory proceedings and talked about resentment, and then it says, and some of us turned it to remorse, and then it was worse. Because you see, I had never been hostile, except for a brief period of my drinking, toward you out here. I'm 5'1.5" tall. But the loathing that I had for the human being that you see up here, I absolutely identify with people that are in jail for murder because I murdered this person. I hated her more than anything in the world. I was disgusted with her. And that was prior to my first drink. It took many years for the disease of alcoholism to progress in my life before it got as bad as it was for me before my first drink. My worst fear, sober, was that I would go back to the way I was prior to my first drink. And I haven't. I haven't. Now, when you have those, and the other thing I want to say is I was real sentimental. Alan talked about being overly sensitive. When I was 13 years old, Elvis Presley came out with a very sad maudlin love song called I Can't Help Falling in Love with You. Okay? Now, I laid up in the bed. I would listen to that song, and I'd just lay up in the bed and sob over that song. Sob! And I had never had a boyfriend or a drink yet. I mean, that's just the way I was. For some people, alcoholism is a curse. In my case, it is my greatest blessing. For some people, Alcoholics Anonymous is a step down. In my case, it was a step up. Because, you see, by the time I was rendered sober 15.5 years ago, I was afraid I was just too dirty, that I'd gone too far, that you guys were like nice alcoholics, that no matter how much I ever acted like you, no matter how much I ever learned to dress, no matter what I ever did, no matter how many showers I ever took, I would never get that inside filth off of me. That I had just gone too far, I was too dirty, it would never come off. And what I have to offer you this morning, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard a man say once that the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are like an inside shower. And I am cleaner today, much of the time, on the inside than I am the outside. And I don't know if that's great news for you. I'm not a pilot for American Airlines. I've never made a lot of money sober. I thought that this weekend. I thought, boy, I hope they understand that I'm 5'1½", and what I've had in my life is a spiritual experience. And my greatest joy in life is being of service to you. I thought that was the highest you ever went in Alcoholics Anonymous, was to be sober, love God, study the textbook, and try and help another alcoholic. And that's just what I do. And that's all I am. And it's my greatest joy. Anyway. I believe the first miracle for me that was tangible was when our house burned down and we got the hell out of Oklahoma. And I arrived in California. And it was a wonderful world. I'll tell you why. Because they had whole cities of stuff in California that we didn't even talk about back home. I saw people, all different sexual preferences, all different colors of hair. I mean, I saw people that had been checked out, and not only were they not ashamed, but they were talking about it and looking to do it again. I couldn't believe it. It was shortly after I was in California that I took my medicine for the first time. I was with a bunch of kids up at a place called Style Park. I was maybe 14 years old, something like that. I don't know. And I was with a bunch of kids, and we'd gotten some booze, and they were all passing around their drinks and kissing and hugging and all that. And I no longer participated in life. I told you, I had thrown myself away. And I had gotten a hold of a bottle of slow gin and a warm quart of Coors. Now, we didn't have martinis. And slow gin was kind of sweet and syrupy, a lot like a cherry Coke. You know what I mean? And I had gotten a hold of these two bottles, and I told the kids that I was going to go over and look at the lights at the edge of the cliff. And I took that warm quart of Coors and that bottle of slow gin with me. And I went over to the edge of that cliff, and I looked at those lights. And I drank that bottle of slow gin, and I chased it with a warm quart of Coors. And that's the way I drank and used other drugs for the next 9 years. Period. It was shortly thereafter that I was introduced to the wonderful world of drugs other than alcohol. And I'll tell you, it was a wonderful world, and I'll tell you why. I'm from a family of alcoholics, and I never wanted to be an alcoholic. And we have a textbook under title in Alcoholics Anonymous that states in there that the great obsession of the alcoholic is somehow, some way, we're going to beat this game. We're going to beat it. And when I found drugs other than alcohol, I really thought I had beat the game. I could kill the way I felt inside, get some distance from me, but I wasn't going to end up like them, the alcoholics. All I did was prove I'm alcoholic. That's why I don't identify as anything different. When I was new in AA, they put that textbook in my hand and told me that if I could find myself within the confines of that textbook, that I too could recover in the manner that was designed. And I found myself in there. My obsession that I was going to beat it. I was going to beat it. And just proved I was a plain old alcoholic. That's all I proved. I made two brilliant decisions based on self at that point, and that's number one, if I could just stay loaded till I died and never love anybody, everything would be all right. Period. Because, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you know that loving hurts just too much. It's not worth it. And that's the career I pursued for the next 9 years. Period. Now, you drank and used like I did. You went to the places I went. There's a line in the textbook, Alcoholics Anonymous, that talks about the alcoholic will reach a point where it cannot differentiate the true from the false. And his alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. I never want to forget. You drink and use drugs the way Alan and I did. Of course you go to jail. I always thought I had a lot of class. I mean, as much class as you can have when you can't see, walk, or talk. But I thought I had some. And I was constantly waking up arrested. I didn't go to jail awake, but I would wake up there. And I never want to forget the first time I went to juvenile hall. I was absolutely terrified. I had never even known anyone that had been in an institution. I wasn't raised to live like that. I mean, I was absolutely terrified. And I also never want to forget that in the end, I always kept a few miscellaneous warrants out so that I could go home. Jail had become home. My alcoholic life had become the only normal one. It became normal for this alcoholic to live in terror to the point I no longer experienced it. It became normal for this alcoholic to see every living human being as the enemy to the point that no other human beings existed anymore. It became normal for me to loathe myself so much that I no longer experienced the compromise. It became normal to be a prostitute. It became normal to do what I had to do in order to get where I was going to go. It became normal. I didn't even see it happening. I started seeking help shortly before my 18th birthday. Now that's been 20 years ago. What? 21 years ago, the end of this month. I'm going to be 39 years old October 30th. And I am so excited about it. Because, you see, I was born here 15 and a half years ago, and there weren't a lot of young people. And I watched those members of AA that were older than me, probably 39, 40, 45. And I watched the women. And there was those women that come in here and get this program and live it. There's a rebirth in the spirit that I would watch those women in their 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s. My sponsor is named Alabama Carruthers, and she's 74 years old. And she is beautiful, and she wears hats. And there's a dignity that, and I'm just so excited that I'm not in my 20s anymore and I'm getting ready to leave my 30s. I mean, my mother said to me recently, honey, you better enjoy it while you've got it, because in our family, the women lose their looks quick. So in your 40s, you're going downhill. And I was able to say to Mother that I believe that probably the second half of my life is going to be the best part of it. But I will be increasingly more beautiful because I live from the inside. Youth is not all it's cranked up to be. It really isn't. Anyway, I drank and used drugs. I ended up here, you know, when I was 18, and I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I will tell you that I wanted what the people in AA had from the very first time I came here. And that was to begin a journey for me that lasted in and out for 5 years. Seemed like everybody in AA knew why I couldn't stay sober but me. And they'd get up and walk clear across the room just tell me what a loser I was at first. And then they even quit doing that. And I can tell you from my vantage point today as I look back, those of you who keep coming back here, who seemingly are the chronic slippers, I'm here to tell you that one day of sobriety, being a slipper in Alcoholics Anonymous, whatever, I believe this, if you can get one moment of sobriety in here, if you're an alcoholic, that is a miracle. The big book says that although continued sobriety is much what we'd rather prefer, sometimes relapses lay the groundwork to freedom. So we don't condemn here. If you're a slipper, you just keep coming here. Keep coming here, and I've got to believe the miracle will happen to you someday because it happened to me. And I kept wondering what was wrong with me. Why I wasn't getting it. I never missed meetings. I'd just go get loaded after them. And each time I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a little bit less hope and a little bit more demoralization and a little bit more despair. And I'm here to tell you, looking back now 15 and a half years, I wondered what I did those 5 years wrong. I never did a thing wrong. Never did a thing wrong. It just wasn't my time yet. I'm here to tell you that in those 5 years, going in and out, I just missed the trip. I went to the very meetings I go to today. But I heard a man say that God's kids can see when they can see and they can hear when they can hear. And I never once in those 5 years going in and out lived in the living, vibrant, alive, all-inclusive program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I live in today. Never once. Nothing was three-dimensional. It was just like people just had skin. Things were flat. Do you know what I mean? Nothing was alive. Nothing was alive because my spirit was dead. Now, I was very fortunate. I heard a guy I listen to these tapes, and I know Joe M. and Charlie P. And they talk about the people that are sick in a whole bunch of areas. Like, they don't have the disease alcoholism. They say they got that disease called normal. And they talk about that they're sick in a whole bunch of areas, but they never get sick enough in one that they have to get better. So they just kind of stay half sick the rest of their lives. You know what I mean? But being blessed with the disease of alcoholism, I had so many problems in my life that they would treat all those symptoms for so long. But being blessed with the disease of alcoholism and it being a progressive disease, what eventually happened to me was this disease got bad enough that it eventually overtook all the other problems, and I had one area that I could get better in. And that's what happened to me. That's what happened to me. My last time out in Alcoholics Anonymous, I made two more brilliant decisions based on self, and that was number one, that I would drink and use till I died, because people had been telling me, Murray, you keep living like this, you're going to die. And I kept thinking, when? And the other thing I said is I will drink and use till something happens to me to make the program of Alcoholics Anonymous work for me the way it did for you guys. Because, you see, I never blamed the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew it was me. And I did not know what was wrong with me. I have learned since. It's called the insanity that precedes the first drink. But I didn't know that then. I had no distance from my disease. It owned me. I believe that's the greatest miracle in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that sober, I can have a thought of a drink and see it. See it. Have some distance from my disease. That's called freedom from the obsession, not being owned. Anyway, I always tell where I ended up because it's very important. Because, you see, by the time I was rendered sober, it seemed like the ladies in Alcoholics Anonymous had cleaned up their talks so much that I thought I was the only one. Men don't do that. Men talk about peeing in linen closets, everybody laughs, and all this stuff. But it would seem like the ladies, that I thought I was the only one, and I was afraid I was dirty. And I swore that if I was ever able to stay sober, that I would stand up and tell where I came from with all the dignity that a spiritual experience gives someone. Being born from the inside. You see, the truth of the matter is, if God could be for me, who could be against me? And I swore I would stand up. Where I ended up, quite simply, was I ended up a very cheap $10 whore walking the streets of Hollywood. In an absolute state of shock, I ended up like that. Because other women end up like that. Women less bright, less pretty, maybe from different circumstances. But not me, and I was going to stop. I had been to AA, and that's what Tom talked about last night. Please hear that the worst of my alcoholism happened after I came to AA. Those of you who are sitting out there tonight, or this morning, that are saying, I'm not that bad, I wasn't either. I wasn't either. I didn't even believe people when they said these things. I ended up a very cheap $10 whore walking the streets of Hollywood, and it was tragic because the only reason I was living like that was I believed I genuinely couldn't have this, and I didn't know why. And there's another line in the textbook, Alcoholics Anonymous, that states, an alcoholic will reach a point where he cannot envision life with or without alcohol, and refers to it as the jumping off place, that he'll know loneliness as few do, and that he'll wish for the end. And that's what happened to me. I started trying to kill myself. You're looking at somebody that's been dead on arrival 3 times. I believe what Tom said last night. I believe there are 2 kinds of recoveries for alcoholics. I had to come to terms with when I was 2 years sober that either God is loving and merciful to all, or he's loving and merciful to none. And when the woman that I loved most in the world, my Aunt Jo, was found dead on the floor when I was 2 years sober of this disease, and I wanted her to have the miracle more than anybody in the world. I never even dreamed she wouldn't get it. You know, we sit in these rooms and we see the recovery and we just assume everybody can be sober. And I just knew she was going to get the miracle. And she didn't. And when they called me, I had to come to terms with that my Aunt Jo had in fact recovered. That even though I believed there was a recovery for her here in Alcoholics Anonymous, either God is all-loving and merciful, and he hears the cries of all alcoholics, or he hears it of none. And in her case, death was merciful. So I woke up, I continued to live, and what happened to me was I became convinced that I wasn't going to die. I've been around AA long enough to hear about this thing called a higher power. And I got to believe that nobody died without God's permission. I didn't know a lot about God. But I'd been trying so hard to die, and I kept waking up. And I got on my knees, and I went to this God that I didn't understand, and I said for me what I believe was the first naked prayer of my life. And by naked, I mean my outsides match my insides. There was nothing left between me and me anymore. There was no more deals. There was no more nothing. It was a naked prayer. And by the way, I've said those prayers 3 or 4 times sober, where every bit of me screamed out to the universe. And without exception, my whole world has changed at those moments. Now, I wish I could make that happen every day. Okay. But what happened at that point was I got on my knees and I went to a God that I didn't understand, except my grandmother had told me that he could see and hear everything he was thinking. Couldn't mess with God. And that reminds me, in my home group, they had a sign. And this is for those of you who are new. It said, I am. Well, I'm trying. Okay. Okay. I got down on my knees and I went to this God that I didn't understand. And I said, God, I don't know what's wrong with me. I've tried everything. I've been in Synanon, I've been in group therapy, I've been in private therapy, I've been to AA, they sent me to NA. I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've done everything I know to do, and I've had the help of the greatest people. And I cannot make it, and would you let me go soon? Now, I had dying in mind, and it was through a very strange series of events that I ended up at another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe, for all intents and purposes, a part of Marie Stenner died that day. When it talks about the spiritual experience in the book, it talks about how a person's attitudes, thoughts, feelings, and actions that heretofore have been denied him come. And that's what happened to me. The way you got me 15 and a half years ago was, I had 17 felonies in the courts. I was not... I am trying to keep talking. This is real hard. The way you got me 15 years ago was I had 17 felonies in the courts. Now, I'm not a big-time criminal. I just made a nuisance of myself. You know, you make it, you stay drunk long enough and you do things long enough, you make a nuisance of yourself long enough. That ends up happening. I mean, I wasn't a big time, you know. But I got scared when I got all those felonies, so I jumped bail on all of them. You know, it's never the alcoholic's problems that are the problem. It's our solutions, right? I got scared when I had 17 felonies, so I jumped bail on all of them. Made perfect sense to me. I had been making my living on my back. I didn't know if I was straight or gay. I owned one pair of jeans because, and no longer owned a pair of shoes because my friends had ripped me off while I was in the hospital. This side of my face was black from a beating, another beating I don't remember because it had become normal. My greatest hope. I knew success. You want to know what success was for me before I got here? Was if I woke up in the morning after having been beaten and there was nobody there because only I had to experience my humiliation. That was success. This side of my face was black from a beating. I was wearing a rib brace, and I had no hope. And I was taken to what I believe to be the greatest place on the face of the earth. I was taken to a place called the Alanest in the San Fernando Valley. They call it the sickest of the sick. And I will be forever grateful those people were as sick as they were. Because, you see, if they had been a little bit weller, they might have looked at that pathetic little girl and said, "You were a what? You did what? Oh, no, you shot heroin. Oh, we can't help you. Oh, dear, you can't stay sober till you change your language. Don't you have any other clothes? Oh, well, she's not an alcoholic of our type. Look at her." But they were just sick enough to believe that the program and the power laid out in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous could take that pathetic little girl and create a miracle in her life. They were sick enough to believe it. And that's when they put that textbook in my hand. I was told 2 very important things. A gal named Jerry walked up to me and she said, "Well, Murray, you think you're going to stay sober this time?" I didn't know. The book talks about if you ask an alcoholic why he does the things he does, if he really gets honest, he don't know. At best, he'll get angry with you, nasty, because we're confused. We don't know. And I said, I don't know. And she told me, she also, she said this to me. She said, you know, Murray, you can't stay sober. And I was so relieved somebody knew. Because ever since I'd been coming to AA, people told me I could stay sober. And I couldn't. She said, you're going to have to find a God of your very own that'll keep you sober no matter what. Now, what that meant for me is that I was going to have to find a God that would keep me sober whether I'd ever be a lady, because I had tried that. I would have to find a God that would keep me sober in the penitentiary, because that's where I was going. I would have to keep a God, find a God that could keep me sober exactly as I was. What came next was, I don't talk about this much, but it's the truth. I found out through a spiritual experience, much like the one Bill Wilson had, that I didn't have to find God. He already knew I was here. I think that's one of the greatest fallacies that we tell people, is that they must find God. If you are sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous this morning, and you are sober, you have already found God. I believe the greatest miracle that ever happens is that we get to hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, I started doing what Jerry Estes said. I got up in the morning. I went to this God that I didn't understand. You know, it's very difficult if you're new, and I think after we're around here for a while, I mean, I take my relationship with God sometimes for granted, but I remember those early days, me as despicable as I was trying to go to God, and all she told me was I had to say, back then AA wasn't multiple choice. You know what I mean? It was like, she told me, ask God to keep you sober. Nowadays you tell somebody, ask God to keep you sober, and they say, I don't like to pray. Who cares? You know, it's like she's... She didn't ask me if I liked to pray. She said, and I thought that was AA. And nowadays you say, I don't like to pray. And they said, well, try this. It wasn't multiple choice. She said, ask God to keep you sober. And I did it. I didn't know how to do it. And I remember those first attempts at prayer where I was in a room by myself, somebody else's room, because I didn't have a place to live. And I would go, it's like, how do you talk to God? Do you know what I mean? And you go, God. God, God, I mean, how do you, and I would say these words and they'd come out so loud and just go out in this room and I felt so stupid, but I did it anyway. And then I was told to ask God to keep me sober and to thank him at night. And then I'd go to bed at night and I'd say thanks and I'd be at AA in between, period. And I became a student of the textbook. And I'm very, very grateful to report to you, those of you who are new, Jerry Estes was exactly right. I cannot stay sober. That is the basis for our whole program. When it says at the last paragraph of chapter 3, once again, we wish to reemphasize that the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. That, what that means to me, what being powerless over alcohol means, and it talks about in the book how self-knowledge avails us nothing. Over and over and over. It's in italics. What that means to me is that no matter what I learn about the disease I have, no matter how many meetings I attend, no matter what I ever do, someday, somewhere, sometime, it's going to be the bottle in me and the bottle's going to win. And it states that that protection must come from a power greater than ourselves. That's the basis of our whole program. As it says in the big book, we place our drink problem in God's hands. That's the one thing I cannot do for myself. Anyway, I started doing that. And I will tell you this. I continued to pray like that. I had nothing else. I believe my greatest blessing in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I drank enough. I hear people in AA talk about when they quit drinking. And I believe you. I believe you quit. But I don't know. Today, standing up here today, I love Jack Daniels. I just love it. And if I ever thought for a moment I had quit, If I thought for one moment there was one shot of Jack Daniels out there for me, and that I had given anything up, that I had quit, I don't think I'd be happy here. You know, the book talks about alcohol beat us into a state of reasonableness, and that's what happened in my case. I got to drink all I could. The way Alabama became my sponsor, she stood up at a podium one day and she said, if you be alcoholic like I'm alcoholic, you can be pouring that stuff down your throat and it can be coming out your nose at the same time and there isn't enough. And I thought, that's me. And that's me. So what happened is alcohol rejected me. I didn't quit it. It quit me. And so there's no illusion left. It quit me. I never quit it. It quit me. So I began to study here. I was fortunate. I was so sick that it kept the social members of AA away from me. I never knew about conventions. I never knew about parties. I never knew about any of that stuff. I was just given that textbook, and I slept on people's floors, and all I had was God. And I began to pray, and you know what? The days started to pass, and I was sober. The days started to pass. And this little hope started coming up inside of me. Maybe this time. And I want to talk to you a little bit about what happens in prayer. Because I have a very rich prayer life today. I am very, very grateful to report. I hear people in meetings talk about, well, you can't sit at home and pray and do nothing. I am very grateful to report that I no longer consider prayer doing nothing. There is. When the book talks about the spiritual life is not a theory, we have to live it. What I've been born into in Alcoholics Anonymous is a very real. The spiritual life is not something stupid and corny and theoretical. If it can keep an alcoholic sober, it can do anything. And that's what started to dawn on me. I kept it up with this God keep me sober. And thanking him at night. And I don't know when the magic happens here. I don't know. You know, I remember that time. And I know there must be somebody here this morning that's in that no man's land. Where you don't belong out there anymore. You know drinking doesn't work for you anymore. But you don't really belong here yet. It's their program. It's like a no man's land where you're in between. And that's a hard place to be. It's a very hard place to be, and that's why we tell you, just keep coming back, keep coming back, keep coming back. And I don't know where that point came, that I continued to pray like that, and I would go, God, God, you know, and all those things. Till I began to pray, and I wasn't alone in the room. The room was warm. And there was some place that my prayers were going. They weren't just going to the walls. Now, I don't know when that happened. And those of you who haven't experienced it and are still wondering won't know or won't find out unless you continue to go, God, God, this is stupid. Just hang in there. Hang in there. The only people that, like the big book says, the only people that don't believe in prayer just haven't tried it enough, you know. But that's what started happening to me, and it began to occur to me that maybe the miracle had happened. And things started to get warm. And little coincidences started to happen, like I didn't have any food or something. And AA members would walk up to me, it'd be 4:30 and I'd be real hungry and I'd be at my group. And somebody would walk up to me and say, Marie, why don't you go to dinner with me? I need some company, I'm all alone. And I didn't have any money. You know, God bless the members of that group. They acted like I was doing them a favor, going to dinner with them, letting them pay for it. I love AAs. You know, they never said, you don't have any money, so you better come with me. And they said to me I was beautiful. You know, all that happened at the Allen's, they told me. There I sat in that pair of blue jeans, and I very quickly put on 40 pounds, and I lost my looks and all those things. And they'd walk up to me, those members at AA, and say, God, you look pretty tonight, Marie. And I didn't, but I believed them. They told me I was an absolutely perfect child of God. That I had a disease called alcoholism, and to take a year out of my life and learn about the disease I had and the way it manifested itself in my life and acquaint myself with the program of recovery. Now, there's been a lot of water under the bridge from those first prayers. I slept on I slept on floors in my home group. I didn't know how I was going to get a job. I didn't know. I had never had a checkbook. I had never done anything. I didn't know anything about life. I could tell you how to clean a size 26 and a half diabetic needle with a light bulb filter. But I'd be damned if I could tell you how to catch a bus. I mean, I just didn't know anything about life. And they told me, take care of your number one problem, and the rest will follow, Marie. And they'd walk up to me and be real gruff. They'd say, I'd be talking about, how am I going to get a job? What am I going to do? And they'd say, what's your number one problem, girl? And I'd say, I knew what to say. I ain't no fool. I'd say, alcoholism. And they'd say, you take care of your number one problem, as written in the big book, and the rest will follow. And you know, it's all come. Those of you who are new and wondering how you're going to learn all the stuff there is to learn, how blessed I am that all over the world, I mean, the combined knowledge and living experience in these rooms that we give for fun and for free, there were people in AA that knew how to get jobs. There were people that know how to do everything. All of that stuff. And they taught me. They taught me. Anyway, I just took care of my number one problem. I want to tell you a little bit about my first birthday. At last, the day had arrived. I had been gifted with 365 days. Okay. Back to back. I mean, not even, no interruption. I was like the AAs. It had happened. Now, these people had fed me and clothed me and done everything for me at this group. And just like an alcoholic, the day had at last arrived and I was afraid nobody was going to care. Now, they had given me their time, their money, everything they had. So I told them my birthday was on a Tuesday and it was on a Monday. And I went to a group in Hollywood to take my cake just in case they weren't going to care. And it was the old Central Hollywood group. And you have to walk down these steps and it has this big round wooden table. And I walked into that room that night. And one of those tables was completely covered with gifts and cards and flowers. And they were all for me. I'll never forget there was a member there that had brought me a music box that played Love Story. And I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest love story ever written in life. You see, I had never been the kind of person that people gave cards or... Nobody ever gave me flowers. That happened to the good people. That happened to the ladies. Nobody ever gave me music boxes. Nothing like that. I sat in this meeting and all of a sudden it occurred to me it was my birthday. I was going to have to say something. I thought, oh my God, what am I going to say? I'm so sick. I don't have a car. I don't have a job. I don't have what these people have. What am I going to tell him? And it was as if my Heavenly Father spoke to me, and it's the reason I'm here this morning. A little guy asked me last night, are you scared to talk to me? I told him, no. Worst that happens, they don't have me back. But what came to me that night is the reason that I come to you this morning. It occurred to me, my Heavenly Father spoke to me because they were thoughts not my own. That no matter how sick I knew I was, through no fault of my own, I had been gifted with 365 days, back to back, of physical sobriety, freedom from the bottle, and that no matter how sick I knew I was, that there were new women and men sitting on the edge of their chair out there that night that would give their right arm to have what I had, that to them I was well. And I began to sob that for the first time in my life I had been an example of something useful, that I was sober. And it's like Tom talked about that. Once you get hooked on that magic, when it's said in the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous, cling to the thought that in God's hands your darkest past can become the greatest treasure you possess. With it, you avert death and suffering for other alcoholics. You know, I see what happens to other speakers. People ask me a lot what happens. I don't speak as much as I'm asked. I do say no to AA requests because it's real funny. You know, I don't know about you guys. They say you got to give it away to keep it. But the more I talk about, like if I talk a whole bunch about meditation, I feel like I've done it. But I haven't. If I talk a whole lot about 12-step work, I feel like I've done it. But I haven't. So I believe the greatest miracle happens is that we're sober here. Anyway, it was shortly thereafter that I turned myself into the police. I was given a suspended 5 to life, and then I became like you. I wanted to move out of L.A. It was very difficult for me to change in L.A. People had known me as big-time dope fiend and, you know, and I was changing. Something was happening to me inside. I was, like, getting soft and caring. I would, like, cry and stuff like that. And I didn't know how to be big and tough anymore. Something was happening. I didn't know this person. And like everything else, I thought I'd like to live up north. And now I went to this God. I figure if God could keep you sober, he could do anything, right? So I mentioned it to God. It wasn't a big deal. I just said, look, God, if you're interested, I'd really, if you have any work for me to do up north, I'd like to be up there. And otherwise, I'll just stay here. You know, I just mentioned it. And I mentioned it to a couple of people in AA. They said, what footwork are you doing? You got to do footwork. Now, I was taught that the footwork, my footwork, is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and everything else is God's business. So I hadn't done much but talked to God about it. And what happened was I got a phone call one day, because by now I was working, some AA got me a job, and somebody from a place called Stockton, California called me and asked me if I'd like to come up here and work. And it was a van line company, so they were going to move everything. I said, sure, that's up north. I ain't no fool. I remembered my prayer. And that's when I arrived in Stockton, and you guys got me with the blue jeans, and that began my journey of changing, becoming the woman that you see standing up here. Thank God for the Al-Anons and that group, Georgia. And I know you guys didn't know the effect you had on me because I was so offensive. But I watched your every move, and I learned to wear pearls. And I remember the first time I went to a department store and felt too dirty to be in there and went to the perfume department. I thought the sales lady behind there was going to throw me out because she really knew who I was. But you see, something had happened inside of me that I was clean, and it gave me courage to walk in there. There's been a lot of water under the bridge in the last years. I'd like to share a few very important events with you in the way that God has manifested itself in my life since then. When I was 5 years sober, I just became a little member of AA. When I was 5 years sober, I was standing in my apartment one day, our little duplex, and by then I was married to a scientist. Don't you think that's funny? I was a mother. I have an 11-year-old son, and he's the hottest thing going. He thinks that I am the greatest thing in the world. I will never forget sitting on the porch with that little boy a few years ago. He was 6 years old then, so it's been 5 years. I was sitting on the porch with him. He said, Mom, do you believe in a devil? He didn't even know how to say it. I said, hell no. He said, I don't either, and I never will, no matter what they tell me. He was whispering it. And he said, Mama, why do some people believe in the devil? I said, oh, same reason they believe in Frankenstein and Dracula and stuff. And I said, yes, David, all you ever need to know about God is that God could love better than anybody or anything in this whole world. That's what God does. God loves good. And he looked up at me and he said, even better than you, Mom? And I looked at him and I said, yeah, baby, even better than me. And he went, God. You know, I always thought children were in a class with dogs. I never understood why people had them. I did. Anyway, by now I had this little blonde-haired, blue-eyed little boy, and I was married to this scientist. And I was standing in this room one day, and the phone call came, and it was a lady named Elsie Faye Maroney, and she asked me, would I be a speaker at the Palm Springs Roundup in Southern California? And I hung up the phone, and I looked at my husband, and my husband said, honey, that's a long ways from that little girl that used to walk the streets. And you know, I didn't know anybody on committees, and you'll notice I didn't thank the committee this morning, because I was just childish enough to believe that God ran Alcoholics Anonymous, and God picked me, and you know what? I still believe he does. The reward... The reward for being of service in Alcoholics Anonymous is being of service. That's all it is. I went and I spoke. I didn't even know how to dress or what to do and all that stuff. And I stood up and told my story about little girl gone astray, end up on a street corner, and God comes along and saves her. And I was up there in my white pumps and my little dress and my pearls. And I got to the part where I'd become a prostitute. And I never told my story in front of dressed up drunks before. And there's a man here this morning that was at that meeting. And I got to that part, and I started to sob. And I mean, when I tell you I started to sob, I mean snot running down my face. I lost it. I have no idea how long I sobbed. I have no idea. All I know was that when I opened my eyes, that room of 3,000 people, as far as I could see, people were standing, giving me a standing ovation with tears streaming down their face. See, that was my day to say thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I thought it was a one-shot deal. I didn't know. And within 6 months, I had been asked to 6 major conventions in and out of the United States. I began to travel, and it began a darkness for me. I got introduced to an Alcoholics Anonymous I never knew existed. I would sit in committee rooms, I would sit different places, and I would hear people gossip. I really believed if people were 15 years sober, they didn't gossip. I really believed, and I started getting scared. And I didn't know what was going on, and I just wanted to be quiet, and I wanted to be little again. When I was 9 and a half years sober, my husband, that I loved so much, had relapsed after many years of sobriety. My father had relapsed. They found him dead 3 years ago. Other people close to me had relapsed. I had continued to do the little program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my circumstances ended up like this. I was 9 and a half years sober. I was in Oregon. My husband had relapsed. I was doing everything I could do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started feeling sorry for myself. I didn't know it was feeling sorry for myself. I was so ignorant when I got to AA. I believed if you felt sorry for yourself. I thought self-pity was like if you felt sorry for yourself when you didn't have any reason, but I had reasons. I mean, I didn't know. And here I was, 9 and a half years sober. I had done all these things. My whole life was turned into crap. Everything near and dear to me had gone by the wayside. People were staring at me. I didn't understand. I started thinking this thing didn't pay off. After having sat at the right hand of Chuck Chamberlain, doing the prayers, doing everything, my life is turned into crap. My husband gets drunk. Everybody in AA runs in to take care of him. I'm hanging on by my bloody fingernails. And they're looking at me saying, what are you going to do about that self-pity, Marie? And I started having thoughts like, what do I have to do, get drunk, to be deserving of the people's loves? I didn't want to be sober 9 and a half years anymore. I just longed for those days at the Alanest when they said, did you drink today, honey? And I'd say, no, and they'd say, then you're a success. I didn't want to have to do any of it, and I started getting angry. I bring up this experience to you simply because I made a promise to God. I had never experienced the obsession to drink sober. When I was 9 and a half years sober, I got to experience it. It lasted for 2 months. Now, I don't know who in this audience here this morning or who at this conference is ready for relapse, but I have never seen a conference that had so much concentration on the years between 5 and 10 years of sobriety. And what happens, you've had 2 speakers that relapsed after major lengths of sobriety, and Tom who relapsed after he didn't know what, and then me. So I don't know, but whoever you are, God loves you very, very much because he set up a conference for you, and you better get rid of whatever pride is interfering with you being here, being sober as long as you are, and not telling people you're in trouble. I don't know who you are, but I have watched it this whole conference. When our book talks about grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. If you're sober here 5 years, you have grasped it. There's no way you can get to 5 years without grasping it. But what these people and what I am talking to you about this morning is the developing. The developing never ends. It must continue at least to 15 years. I don't know about the rest. But I will tell you that what happened to me was I experienced the obsession to drink, and it lasted for 2 months, where every waking moment I was obsessed with the thought of a drink. You won't go back to where you came from. Your husband will put you in one of these fancy hospitals. If you drink, nobody's going to expect anything from you in AA anymore. If you drink, your mother will have to take care of this child. If you drink, maybe you won't have to give up your marriage. I didn't want to give up that marriage. It was the only kindness I had ever known. If you drink, all of this happened. What happened to me was another miracle. I was in a town, and a letter came that had been sent to 5 different places from a kid in my home group that had missed me. And I opened that letter, and it said, "Hi, beautiful." And I read it, and I called him. And I told him everything that was going on in your life, my life. And he said, "Marie, get out of there." I said, he said, "Get out." See, I had reached a point where I was no longer concerned about what I was doing. I was concerned about whether I was doing it gracefully. Now, the sickest thing that I can think of, here I was wanting to drink, and members of Alcoholics Anonymous were telling me to go to Al-Anon. If you are an alcoholic and you're wanting to drink, your rear end belongs in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, not in Al-Anon, ACA, nowhere else. I had gotten so far away from the disease of alcoholism, you know, that sobriety, I have a living problem, all that stuff, that I proved to myself exactly what the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous says is true. That what we have is a daily reprieve contingent upon our spiritual maintenance. That we are not cured of alcoholism. I got on a plane and I ended up at that LNS again, and an old guy looked at me and said, "Marie, resentment by any other name is still resentment." And I had to pick up a pencil and a piece of paper and write all of that out. And I took an inventory as if I had never taken one. And I proved to myself, and it's no longer my, I don't have to wonder about it anymore. Every line that the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous says is true. That resentment shuts us off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and for us to drink is to die. And I'm also here to report to you that the steps worked for me as well at 9.5 years as they did when I was new and have continued to. And that began my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, starting all over again. Now, the reason I'm here this morning, and I want to tell you, I ended up sleeping on people's floors again. I went through whatever I had to go because sober was good enough. You know, I remember being at my group and somebody saying, how are you today, Marie? I said, "I'm sober." They said, "Is that all?" I said, "Well, I don't know. I've heard that's pretty important around here." I still believe this. You know what I mean? That's why I'm here this morning. That's why I told you I didn't drink yet. I believe this. I believe that I am further away from my last drink than many of you in this audience. I also believe that I'm just as close to my next one. When I tell you that I believe I have a terminal disease, I absolutely, and I act like it. That's why I sit on front rows of meetings. That's why I go to meetings. That's why for every one I speak at, I go to 4 that I don't speak at. And what had happened to me at 9.5 years is what Alan talked to you about, the 10th step. I had not stayed current. I had had a lot back up. And I was carrying it all on my shoulders. And the steps worked. Thank you, God. Thank you, God. A lot's happened since then. It seems like I've had 3 distinct sobrieties. My first 5, the second 5, and this last 5. I want to share something with you that my sponsor said to me a few years ago. I was... All of this trauma had passed just like all the other traumas passed. Money, marbles, and chalk. Apartments. All that stuff. I was about 13 years sober. My little boy was back home because my husband had drank. His life got better. He married and they got custody of the child. I mean, I thought it wasn't supposed to happen like that. Got to think this deal didn't pay off. You know. When I used to pray for my daily bread, I didn't care if I got corn, peas, or what. Somewhere I wanted started wanting chicken only. You know. Anyway, I was about 13 years sober, and I went back to being a member of AA. I quit speaking. I started going back to county jails and living the AA I knew. you know. And Alabama and I were visiting one day. Now, I don't know if you have sponsors like this in Stockton, but I suppose you do. I was talking about something. I don't know what it was. But, you know, the kind of sponsors where you're talking about horses, and you're really into your horses. And then they come through and talk about, well, it's almost time for Christmas. And you go, what? And I thought, you know, maybe Alabama just, oh, she had brain damage. I don't know. You know, she didn't know. Sometimes I think she's not listening to me, which is an error. The wisdom of the Spirit here is incredible for those of you who are new. And I was talking about something, and she looked at me, and she said, baby, when I listen to you talk, you talk as if the best has already happened. And I was 13 years sober, and I got to thinking about that. I thought, well, yeah. I mean, look at my life. Look at all that I am. Look at all the miracles I've had. Who could want more? I mean, I guess I did feel like that, and my job was just kind of to give it to you. Do you know what I mean? Like the best had already happened. I had my marriage. I had been loved. I've traveled. I've had spiritual. Who could want more? I'm far overpaid. So I guess I did feel like that. And she looked at me and she said, baby, you're only a teenager. She said, I've been your length of sobriety, and I'm here to tell you the best is yet to come. And I looked at her, and she said, I want you to go home and get on your knees and ask your God to help you feel in your heart that the best is yet to come. And I did what my sponsor asked me to do. And you know what? I'm here to tell you, the last 2 years, God, what if I had missed them? They have been so exciting. I want to share with you something about God. I had a problem in Alcoholics Anonymous not hearing well. I have a friend named Cindy that said it better than I can. She says, I have a unique ability to hear things exactly as they aren't. That's me. Now, I sat at Chuck Chamberlain's feet for many years. He was my friend and my teacher. And he would say to me, because he was from the South, he would call me Faye Marie. Very few people get away with that. He'd say, Faye Marie, if you would but find God, look deep within yourself. Now, what I heard Chuck say for 10 years was, if you would find God, look for God deep within yourself. That's not what he said. So I spent 10 years looking for God inside of me. That's not what he said. He talked about self-examination, the fourth step and the tenth step, the freedom from resentment, fears, and remorse. See, my job is to get empty of self, and I'm automatically filled with God. I have grown in effectiveness with the tenth step. For those of you who hear all the time, your head is out to get you, don't listen to your head. That's tragic, because we have no chapter in the big book, chapter to the head. We don't have a solution to the head, but one of the promises in Alcoholics Anonymous is peace of mind. And I have grown in effectiveness in the tenth step. And today, when I get up and my mind is racing, all that means to me is that I need a tenth step. And I began to stay current after that experience. And when I wake up in the morning and my mind is racing, I get out a pencil and a piece of paper. And I list the manifestations of the human ego, resentments, fears, and remorse. I get down on my knees. I was many years sober before I read the big book as it was written, and found out that God could direct my thoughts, that I could ask for a divorce from my thinking, that I was no longer, when it says in the third step, relieve me of the bondage of self. What that means is I am a slave to the human ego, fears, resentment, and remorse. They own me. I cannot, it says, the big book says, we cannot wish them or will them away any more than we could alcohol. This was our simple course of action. And I list that, and then I get down on my knees. I write out my six-step prayer. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, the good and the bad, because I'll tell you, the longer I'm sober, it's never my bad ideas that get me in trouble. I have a bad thought. I ask God to remove it. I take some action. It's my good ones. Self-deception. The human ego is awesome. It's my good ideas that get me in trouble. So when I go to God and I say, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, the good and the bad, I now ask that you remove from me every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. Grant me strength as I go from here to do your bidding. I get on my knees and I do what page 86 says. I ask God to remove the resentments, the fears, and the remorse. And I envision a divorce in my thinking. Asking God to divorce me from that madness and to direct my thinking. And it's been the most awesome experience that it works. It works. I have experienced peace of mind in the last 2 years. I would have missed it because I thought that's all there was. So when I look at you members that are 30 years sober, 20 years sober, what hope you give me that there's more and the best is yet to come and the spiritual life is not a theory, that we can have it all, that we can grow in effectiveness and understanding and we don't have to drink. We don't have to drink anymore. And that promise never ends. I don't know how long I've been talking, and I don't know that I have anything else to say, and I hope it wasn't too long, and I hope it wasn't too short. But thanks a lot.